Welcome to Full Spectrum with JP, where we discuss the science that is behind the science that is invisible in the dark corners of the recesses of the secret space program, dark research of the 20th century. We find the full spectrum of science. Join us tonight. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
Excellent. Good afternoon, good evening, and good morning, wherever you might be. This is JP, and we've finally got another full spectrum show. It's a very rare bird because I have a life, and Thursday evenings, you know, is like people like to come and see and have a cup of tea and, you know, but anyway, having a cup of tea with me this evening, is another English dude, who's into energies and, has done a lot of research. And, basically I want to, kind of in a way pick your brains, but also in another way make it so that how do people start, in the whole scheme of what we call going off grid. So basically, you know, I'm just messing about with stuff, here in my house and, you know, using what limited knowledge I have and building things and playing with things and seeing how circuits work and stuff like that. So I'm kind of going through my teenage years of, learning electronics once again. To help me with this great quest, because one of the things my spiritual guide said to me is like, learn electronics and you will then learn alphysy. Like we have alchemy, which is the process of elevating the soul using chemistry. This is the science of doing it by using the concepts that we use in electricity, which are a higher energy form. So, after all that, I'd like to introduce my guest today is Wynne Keach. Good evening, Wynne. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm fine, JP. Very good to be back on your show.
It is.
Thanks for inviting me.
It is. It's great to have you back. Now, I connected with you a few days ago, and you started talking on Facebook on a chat, and I thought, this can't just be for me. This is information that everybody needs, and because at the moment we don't know how well for once electricity is going to be in potential interruptible supply and potentially expensive supply and therefore interruptible. So some of these things we can use as perhaps like a stopgap. Like we have the concept of a UPS on our computers these days, so that if the power fails, the computer keeps going. Well, essentially, the house that runs off grid is essentially just a big one of those, with a little bit of finery added to the internal idea. But essentially, that's the concept, isn't it?
That's absolutely the concept, JP. It is the future of energy systems is to have distributive smart grids, which is a funny way of saying that, yes, your house becomes a big UPS, and it may or may connect to the grid when it wants to or when it doesn't want to. That's the way to go. I'd better explain how I got into this.
Please.
And how I've become something of a global expert at it. Not by choice. It's by virtue of a lot of hard work and the fact that that's what my day job is. As you know, well, most people know me for UFOs, crop circles, that sort of thing. But people have known me from before that time, or before that time was in the mainstream media, know that I did a lot of work on things like authentication system for computers, PIN systems for banking systems, all that sort of thing. Well, after I went through that phase, I decided to chill out for a bit. So I retreated to my house here, which is on a barren moor top on the North Yorkshire Moors, looking out to sea and then looking out to the forests behind me and the moors on the top of me here. And I'm in a very remote spot. My nearest neighbour is 2.5 miles away. And yet, in my nearest town is 6 miles away. So the local scarcity of people is quite extraordinary for this part of the coast. It's a very special spot. Downside to this is that the length of cable from me to the nearest phone exchange is 7 miles, and also the same for my electricity connection. And being in a very exposed, windswept, storm-beaten area in the winter, we're very used here to having an intermittent electricity supply any time after November and any time up to March, where generally electricity cables here get struck by lightning, chewed by sheep, pulled over by tractors, and electricity supplies are very intermittent at the best of times here. Which led me to think, okay, I'm on a house here, I've got my own water supply, I have my own sealed spring, I have my own drainage from septic tanks and what have you. And my only two connections to the outside world are my electricity supply and my phone connection. So I thought, well, that's my entire dependence on society here, just by peculiarity of where I live. So my house is a perfect vehicle for testing how to live off-grid. If I can replace those two connections with technology, and I don't really care about the phone, to be honest. You know, I can take it or leave it if I don't. Prefer not to be with it, to be honest. But the main one is the electricity connection. And with modern society and modern household devices, commercial things, everything runs on electricity. So how do you get over the dependence on this? And that's how I started 10 years ago. So I started out with what were then very expensive solar panels, experimented with them, bought the very early examples of the sort of do-it-yourself wind turbines, which were terrible. And I started to look at all the technologies that were available and technologies that were emerging, and started modelling how the house runs, started replacing all the systems with replacement systems, and living the life of what do you need to do to live off-grid. And it soon becomes very plain what you need, and what are luxuries, and what are the essentials. And that's where I started. And 10 years later, I've obviously grown that into developing the world's most successful mini wind turbine, the stealth generator known as Ridgeblade, bird bat friendly, silent, visually unobtrusive, largely designed to be here because I'm in the national park here. And when I initially started, I wanted a turbine that the national parks wouldn't notice I'd put on the roof. That's how it started. And then actually I worked with the national park and developed exactly the systems they wanted, which is why I have tremendous support from the National Park here, who have been absolutely brilliant, and really have shown the rest of the country how to do this sort of thing. And by virtue of this, I've grown through, obviously, wind generation systems. I've seen the advances in solar systems. I have advanced technology myself for solar heating systems. I'm regarded as one of the world experts on battery storage and energy storage systems. And I've taken it from a curiosity 10 years ago to the fact that I've lived completely off-grid here for 4 years. You know, I'm talking to you now over electricity that's generated from wind and solar. The house that I'm sat in now is being lit by electricity from wind and solar. The backup lighting system is run from solar and battery storage. The house system is running from battery storage. The whole system is off-grid. Everything from, you know, the washing machine, the fridge, the television, computer, everything here is pure green renewable energy. And it's a normal house, well, as normal as my house gets, living a normal life. And that's the only way to finally work out the solution, is to live it.
Well done, mate. Really. I mean, well, because that's really where I'd like to be. So you started 10 years ago, I started maybe 2 years ago. So, good. Got 8 years to get here.
Yeah, I had a long start, and then I had 6 years, of course, becoming a wind turbine expert. So, wind was the missing component. If you take a normal house consumption, now my house does not consume the normal house consumption, although it's bigger than a normal house. My house is probably 3 times the size of a normal house, but it still uses a third of the energy of a normal house, by virtue of energy-saving lighting, energy-saving equipment, clever use of heating systems, etc., etc. But nonetheless, if you take a typical house in the UK, that requires 4,200 kilowatt-hours per annum, generally, of electricity, or roughly 12 kilowatt-hours a day, or half a kilowatt-hour per hour on average to run a house. And to do that from the size of the small houses we have in the UK, it isn't physically possible to put enough solar panels on a south-facing roof to generate that capacity.
You'd need several houses to run, yeah, because of Britain's lack of sun.
Yeah, and we now have the smallest houses in Europe. Our average house size is now 76 square metres for a new built house. It's the smallest in Europe.
Little boxes on the hillside. So, essentially what we need is something that is kind of, it captures the wind. But Wyn, here's the thing. Is there anything that captures the impact of the rain on your roof? Because surely there's some sort of piezo driver that could capture the impact of rain on your roof to generate some sort of voltage.
Yeah, you could, but there's not enough energy there. That's the trouble. The amount of water that runs off your roof, if you measure how long water runs off your roof and the amount of it over a week, you maybe have a couple of kilowatt hours of energy coming off the roof, which is only the same that you're getting in an hour from 8 solar panels. So it's not a great return. Whereas one of our wind turbines, for instance, will produce as much as a 2 kilowatt solar array. So, it's horses for courses. Grab every bit of natural free energy you can, but do it in an appropriate fashion, i.e. something that's cost effective, is mechanically and electrically robust, simple, easy to maintain, and affordable.
Okay, so here's the thing. Say somebody wanted to start, just like dip their toe in the water,
yep,
and maybe say have a few internal lights that have a UPS system. That's one way you could actually hack a UPS system to just put a bigger battery into it, couldn't you? Or sort of hook it up to a bigger battery.
Yeah, you can do that, so long as you don't put a heavy workload on them, but if you're going to use them for continuous cycling, so they don't overheat and degrade. But yes, you can put a bigger battery system on and have, say, a 3 kilowatt UPS just running at around a kilowatt, providing the lighting for the house. That's absolutely fine. And you can charge that with solar panels. And if you just take solar panels and use simple charge controllers to a battery system, you've got a very effective light duty circuit backup system. I run both systems in this house. Obviously, I've tried everything. So my house is quite unusual in that it has 4 electrical wiring systems.
that's sounding like mine's becoming, definitely.
Well, I tried everything.
Yeah.
And obviously, once you put the stuff in, it becomes a legacy system.
Well, here's the thing, Wyn. Have you used copper tape as wiring?
Yes, you can, if it's low current. Things like LEDs have very low current consumption. So, yes, that's a perfect solution. You find when you start trying to replace wiring in the house, that's the biggest problem. If you're going to run first thing I did was put a 12-volt lighting circuit through the house and then run a load of SMD and Cree lighting units in all the ceilings and the light fittings around the house. And that's fine, but the effort to put the wiring in is quite extensive. Once you've got it in, it's absolutely fantastic. So I have an entire backup system in the house here. I have, sort of 4 truck batteries in a cupboard upstairs, which goes to a solar charging system on the roof. And that is my backup system. And I have a second set of switches for the lights around the house, and they turn on 12-volt systems. And most times I just use the 12-volt system. I'm sitting here now. In this room, the main lighting is off the 12-volt circuit on LED, and the two standard lamps I have here are actually my developmental UPS, micro UPS systems. I have those, which I'm hoping to produce this year as well, which are proper house lighting that has in built-in micro storage and micro UPS. So I have an LED lighting system here that's more efficient than a compact fluorescent. And if I unplug the trickle charger to it, it will keep running for another 12 hours.
I see. So this is like so what you did there is basically you miniaturized the UPS so that it runs a single lamp.
Yeah.
Interestingly, I've also been working on things like that. I wanted a lamp that would work like a mobile phone. You know how you can have a mobile phone in your hand, or you can plug it in and it'll still work. So
yeah,
I wanted,
exactly,
Yeah.
I have exactly that. I've designed some, sort of exclusively designed ones, but I have the working prototypes here, which look like normal house lighting. The only difference is I can pick it up and carry it up the garden, and I can sit outside and it'll work for another 12 hours if I want to.
How very handy. How very handy. And do they run off a USB?
They run off a switch mode charger, so, normally you just plug them into the mains as you would a normal light, and the split mode, the switch mode charger is continually charging an internal storage battery, and that is then providing the output to the LED system. So if you unplug the mains, it continues to automatically work from the battery for another 12 hours.
Excellent. And how big is this? Is this like a lamp standard? Standard lamp?
This is a lamp standard, and it's producing 600 lumens, so equivalent of a 50 or 60 watt light bulb. And I have a couple of those in this room running right now. I use them all the time.
And are they like a kind of traditional reproduction or like modern chrome dome?
I've got a sort of brass smart standard lamp here of sort of Victorian design on one, and on the other I have a smart modern one. There's various types I'm testing and evaluating.
But
the interesting thing is this came out of a project. I did some free work for a friend who had a project called the Light from Light Project. And this was to produce a super low cost but very effective lighting system, self-contained, for Northern India, Pakistan, Bangladesh. And we had a target price to produce a system that had a solar panel that could charge the system in a day, provide 6 to 7 hours of light on 3 light units that was enough to light a small house. It has to be packaged and delivered to those countries for $56. And I designed that system and had it manufactured. And the units from that are the basis for the UPS lighting system here.
I see. So you could even mass produce them further and make them even more available to places in the world.
Yeah, yeah. So basically, you could take any particular lamp standard design you want, and for the addition of $56 worth of equipment, you can convert that into a UPS system that not only can run off the mains but be charged off solar as well.
Excellent. So let's talk about storage. We have LiPo, we have lithium, we have nickel metal hydride, we have nickel cadmium, we have lead and sulfuric acid, none of which are particularly pleasant things.
And there's more unpleasant things as well.
Exactly.
Yes, storage is the biggest issue right now, and it's going to be the biggest issue for the main systems of the world over the next 10 to 15 years. Grid storage goes hand in hand with two things. One is peak demand, which is becoming increasingly more significant as we remove coal-fired and gas-fired power stations to reduce carbon emissions. We're now perilously close to not having enough capacity in the country, for instance, to produce peak demand. So when everybody turns the kettle on at 7 o'clock, once the electric mountain has taken up the 2-gigawatt surge after 70 minutes, we're getting a bit thin on the ground, so they have to bring diesel generators in to back up the missing power stations now. And this is going to get worse and worse over the next decade. Then when you add to this the other factor, which is that we're about to suddenly start seeing millions of plug-in hybrid electric cars appearing all over the country. Now, each of those has the same demand as a house. So you're effectively looking at the extra grid demand of 1 to 2 million houses a year starting in the next 3 years. So these things added to a 75-year-old grid system in this country means that unless somebody spends the best part of £500 billion upgrading it, then the lights are going to start going out. So the only solution to this is to actually get the end consumer to look like an ideal consumer, i.e. the house, instead of having its own load profile across the day when it has peaks and troughs, can actually make up the demand for the peaks when it needs to from storage. And when there are the troughs and they can't get rid of the electricity during the day, it can take some in to store for later. And this is really the way to do it. So for each car you put out there, you really need to have a house that is going off grid with its own internal microgrid, really.
So that's the, that would be the kind of incentive, is that you have this whole package, that the thing you live in and the thing that you drive around in are all connected at the heart with this same power unit. Like, that's a Tesla concept. Well, I mean, many people have had this, like there's the motor, you know, and the motor, you could even have a motor that plugs into the house that supplies the hot water as well.
Oh, yeah, so you can do that. I have a system called Heat Grabber that'll do it for much less money. The thing with the storage is that the electricity grid system is going to morph over the next decade. It's going to change the same way that PC computers have. They started out as mainframe computers, and the mainframe computer is the equivalent of your power station. It's a big fixed infrastructure that's efficient in its own environment, but sends out the information over a wide network, and that slows the thing down, and you have more and more terminals, and the thing grinds to a halt. And so you eventually invent the PC so that it can take some of the local processing away, which is really what a non-off-grid house is. It's the PC equivalent of a power station. And then, of course, using renewables, like my Ridgeblade and solar PV panels and the Heat Grabber heat generators, you can actually generate the renewables on site I can make any house in the world carbon negative. So you can actually have your house as its own miniature power station on this grid. So you have a central processing mainframe computer, which is your power station. And then you have a smart PC, which is your house. And the information stroke energy can be balanced and optimized. And you'll see that the entire market will eventually morph to the houses themselves being the power stations, the same way that we no longer have, you know, small mainframe computers in our house. We have a PC or we have a laptop or a tablet. The whole thing miniaturized and became more portable and more distributed. You'll see the same thing with energy systems. Energy systems will start generating at source and become more distributive.
The equivalent of the tablet is the, you know, and I've got a few of them. I don't know how many people are aware of these, but they're called energy blocks or power banks. And basically, I have this is my favorite one. I'll just turn on my camera so Wynn can see it. This is my favorite one, which has, basically it's got lithium batteries in it.
Yep,
and
another one.
It's got, two USB sockets for charging things from, and a USB, socket for, charging. This one has a solar panel on one side.
Yep.
And, a floodlight. I'm not going to turn it on, but it's a floodlight on the other. It's really, really bright.
I mean, that's really good.
Yeah, it's also got one of those kind of flashy.
Oh, excellent.
Flashing things. Yeah.
That's a really good one.
Yeah.
Yes, that's basically the innards that go in my UPS lighting. The idea is you have a cartridge that, you can plug in the light system and, you can have your solar panel in the garden and plug your cartridges in for recharging outside. So yes, that's exactly the system I use.
Exactly. And these all use, this kind of, it's a development of the collapsing field technology, which is also known as the jewel thief, or the what do you call it?
It's a buck boost amplifier.
Buck boost amplifiers. I've only come across these in the last couple of years, and because when I was a kid, if I wanted to change DC to DC, I couldn't do it. It's like
it was a problem for Edison.
It was a big problem, you know. Yeah, that's how do you do that? So Tesla comes along, well, you chop it up. Yeah. So anyway, and basically what this is a the DC is chopped up very, very finely, and then it becomes AC, and then it's transformed to another frequency. And then it's kind of clamped down using a voltage clamp circuit so that it can have a variable output. You can have a variable output, you can have a variable current, and it all does it by chopping the voltage into tiny little slices and then reconstituting them on the other side. Awfully clever. Where did this technology come from? I haven't seen this, you know, on the market. suddenly it just appeared? Where did that come from?
It's been there for many years. Generally, those type of amplifiers are the old Bucket Brigade type of transformer systems. They became electronic, but they became integral parts of inverter systems. And inverter systems became very important for solar PV power generation. So an awful lot of work went into producing buck boost amplifier type circuits for all the better quality inverters so that they can track effectively and match impedance effectively. It was the whole drive for efficiency and cost efficiency in solar photovoltaic. That's what drove it.
So let's discuss the buck boost amplifier, ladies and gentlemen, because, I mean, you know, this is a nerd out. This is a total nerd off. We're taking no prisoners. We're not explaining anything, you know, buck boost amplifier. All right. So let's just go in. Well, actually, we are explaining things, but it's not going to be sugar coated. A buck boost amplifier. Can you explain who developed it and how it works?
Crikey, who developed it? That goes back a long time. But there are basically two circuits. There's the buck circuit and there's the boost circuit. The buck circuit is the one that's very similar to the switch mode amplifier that you have in all your chargers for your laptops and most electronic equipment, TVs, PCs, laptops these days. That's something which, as you say, takes in this case a DC signal rather than the AC signal in a switch mode power supply. The same principle. It takes a DC voltage and it chops it. It chops it and it charges two banks alternatively of capacitors. And it then uses the charge in the capacitors to be basically spooned into the output stage, which is smoothed by a feedback controller. So the output from it slices it up according to how the voltage is coming out the other side. And the lower the voltage is coming out the other side, so if it's low below the target voltage, it allows a bigger slice every time it goes through its cycle to transfer the electricity through the capacitors on the charging side. Then if the voltage goes over the target, then it reduces the slice that it takes. So it's like it's chopping the slice of the cake of the electricity coming through according to how it's squeezing out through a little hole at the end, like a sausage. And that way it has a quite well-regulated and quite smooth DC output voltage. And that's great for taking a higher voltage and stepping it down to a low one without having losses that you would normally have in resistive circuits, which would waste part of that energy through the voltage drop. This is a pure charging and discharging system. So you're looking at efficiencies of 95% or better, equivalent to a transformer. The boost circuit is the same thing in reverse. That's taking alternate banks of capacitors and charging them and actually amplifying the output by a clever arrangement of the capacitor system so that the charge is actually multiplied as it goes through the charging stage. But the same process, it's a feedback control circuit, just a little chip which is monitoring the output and the input, and it's changing the time slicing on the charging in input and output. So one brings it down and one brings it up. And if you have those two circuits in a single amplifier, you can control the input and output voltages over a very wide range. And those circuits are very easily available now. You can buy them on eBay and order them from China. I've got one sitting on the desk here, 120-watt buck boost amplifier. I think it's about £7. And that'll take a voltage in from about 1.2 volts to around 50 volts, and it will output it anything from 24 to 60 volts, which is great. So, for instance, for a charging circuit, that's absolutely perfect. If you've got, if you've got a lithium storage pack, as you have there, lithium storage packs the voltage don't exactly match as a replacement for lead acid cells. So you have a slight inconsistency. With an amplifier like that, you can take even a much lower voltage. So say you had 7.2 volts, high capacity lithium ion system there, you could put it into the buck boost amplifier and you could charge a lead acid battery in your car, say at 14.4 volts. And the losses would be around 5 or 6%. Whereas before the buck boost amplifier, if you were going to use that, you would lose probably 30 to 40% of that energy in that transformation. So yes, it's the equivalent of an electronic transformer and it uses capacitors to switch and boost and reduce it DC voltages in the same way that a transformer boosts or reduces AC voltages.
Hey, so that's the buck boost amplifier, and that enables DC voltages to be switched. Now, the difference between frequencies. Now, when we talk about AC, we're talking about 50 cycles, 60 cycles a second.
Yep.
But these amplifiers use a completely different frequency band. What's their general range?
They're usually in the ultrasound range. They're usually switching at about 30 kilohertz internally. So these are very fine slices. So if you can imagine it as a switch that's charging a capacitor bank, and a capacitor is really just like an electronic battery, really. It's like a special type of battery that charges very quickly and discharges very quickly. So if you can imagine something that's it's got a switch and it's saying, okay, say I've got 5 volts here and I want to charge that capacitor to 3 volts for its output, I can only connect it for a very short period of time, otherwise it will go past its charging point. So normally, if you're doing it with your hands, you'd have to be really, really quick and very accurate to do it. This circuit is doing that by switching a transistor between the capacitor and the input and the output. So it's doing it 30,000 times a second, and it's got the ability to say, I'll do that for a 30th of a thousandth of a second, I'll do that for a 30th of a thousandth of a second. Yeah, we can do it, we'll switch it again, we'll switch it again, we'll switch it again, the voltage isn't quite there, it isn't quite there, it's there, right, we'll stop switching. And now it's dropped below, so we'll switch it in again, we'll switch it in again, oh, it's gone over, we'll switch it off again, and that's how it regulates it.
And this is what we call a voltage regulator. And as you say, they are very cheap. I mean, for a couple of quid, a few dollars, you can get one of these things, and for instance, I've ordered a couple, and they're a 100 watt, boost amplifier. So you can take your 12 volt rate, you can take your 12 volt battery, which is running maybe between, well, and this is something I want to talk to you about, anywhere between, sort of 10 volts and, if you were lucky to get 13.8 out of it. And this is, you know, this is the subject, of the evening, is like, how do we get that top up thing going? Because no matter how much sun I seem to get, and how much that turbine seems to turn, these batteries don't seem to get more than about, 12.6 if I'm lucky. And that runs down to about 11. And I just feel like if it had a little bit more, it's like it's running, it's like got a, it's got an overdraft at the bank. And so whenever it gets paid, it has to pay off the overdraft first before it can get anywhere. You know, do you see my analogy?
I understand exactly what you're saying. Yes, one of the good uses of these things, as I put them to, is in wind turbine systems. Now, wind turbines have a higher output voltage range than solar. Solar panels, if you get a big panel, you know, a 250 watt panel, they'll generally put a voltage out between 30 to 32 volts. And when you get a bit of sunshine, they'll come in quite quickly at 25, 26 volts. Reasonable sunshine, 30, 31 volts all day long, and then drop off again in the evening. So the voltage variation isn't very great. But with a wind turbine, for instance, the ones I have, they have a three-phase generator, a high voltage generator, and you know, when they're just idling, they're producing 30 to 60 volts. And then when the wind gets up, they're producing 400, 450 volts. So you have to have an inversion or a charging system that can cope with that wide range of voltage. But also, the important thing with wind is to load the wind turbine correctly. So you have to be able to control at each voltage output exactly how much energy you're going to draw from the turbine to keep the turbine running as efficiently as possible, and also to keep the generator system running as efficiently as possible and the electrical supply and inversion system running at its maximum efficiency. So there's an envelope of performance that's optimal. And the only way you can do that is to have smart components that respond intelligently to the voltage. So for instance, I have inverters that have buck boost amplifiers built in. And so they can handle a range from 30 volts to 540 volts. And so that voltage range can go in, and I can program into it exactly the power curve for my turbine so that we know we get every ounce of power out of it. And it will, you know, maintain the 240 volts output perfectly from 30 volts to 540 from the wind turbine. but it'll also do it at the optimal loading and therefore the maximum aerodynamic and mechanical efficiency of the entire system. And that can make as much as a 50% difference to the power output of a wind turbine system without any trouble at all. And in fact, in some, it can make as much as a 70% difference, depending on how they're set up. Now, the trouble with batteries, as you've got a little wind turbine there, a little sort of
Let me just fill you in. Thankfully, through donations, and birthday presents, I've landed myself I think it's a 300 watt wind turbine. It's a six bladed, it's quite old, but it's, you know, the bearings are lovely. It's just, it's beauty to watch the thing because it's very, very quiet. And I've got one of those and I've got various little solar panels. I've got a 7 watt flexi thing. But I've just also now acquired a 140 watt, solar panel, which is sitting in my conservatory, not on the roof. But the thing is, it never seems to get that extra voltage. So what I really need to do is to use a, one of these boost amplifiers to, right. So the other thing that I bought, was a bunch of capacitors. And I've made this big capacitor pack by joining three in parallel, five deep, which has got, 2.7 volts to, so it's like 13.5 volts. So that's my capacitor bank. And can I now just throw that across the turbine? I also put a rectifier across the turbine.
That would be useful. Yeah. Yes. From what I understand, you've got a little, I think it's 300 or 400 watt unit, the sort of things you get on yachts. Yep.
Yes. It probably did come off a yacht because we have lots of boats around here.
Yeah. They tend to be single phase, either AC or DC output, depending on the design. But, they're a hort. They're a horizontal axis wind turbine, i.e. a propeller on a stick. Yeah. Now, they are characterized by, first of all, the speed of rotation goes up very quickly in strong winds. The power they produce goes up by the cube of the wind velocity. They're also characterized by being particularly useless at low wind speeds. So the point you have is that when you've got normal low wind speed that you get most days of the year, the thing is effectively idling. It's tickling along, but it's not producing very much oomph, as it were. And because it has to be designed to operate across the full wind range, so although you might have on a normal day a 10 mile per hour wind, that turbine's got to survive 100 mile an hour winds, and it's still got to operate correctly at that. So most of the time it's not only operating at a tenth of its wind speed, but because it's due to the power cube law, it's producing a thousandth of the power it would do at its maximum theoretical output if you could actually tap it at that high wind speed.
So that's a dynamic range that is difficult to work with.
That's the entire rationale behind the crossflow turbine that I designed, the Ridgeblade. It's optimized for low and mid wind speeds. It just dumps the energy at high speed. So it's an entirely different dynamic to a normal propeller. But the problem with the propeller is that to be effective, it has to rotate relatively quickly. That's why the propeller systems produce a lot of noise. When you get to big systems, the blade tips are traveling, you know, close to the speed of sound, and they're producing sonic shockwaves when they go round. They have to do that to maintain the aerodynamic efficiency because it's the compound velocity of the wind approaching the turbine and the turbine rotation. It's a bit sort of, the blade is effectively karate chopping the wind at an angle. And it's the combined velocity of the blade approaching at a certain angle to the wind that is the actual wind speed that goes over the blade. And it needs that to require the efficiency because it can only work in a blade lift mode. Okay, it has to work like an aircraft wing. Which is another thing that we designed out when we did the Ridgeblade. The Ridgeblade works in three modes. So the problem is the blades have to go relatively quickly, and in doing so they produce relatively low torque at low wind speeds. So the problem being that when you put it to try and charge a battery, which requires a relatively high torque, i.e. high charging current, at a relatively low voltage, the blade ends up rotating, it effectively flatlines at the speed that the output voltage is of the battery. So it produces a lot less current than is useful for charging the battery, but loses a lot of its aerodynamic efficiency because the blade's rotating much slower than it would do to reach its maximum efficiency in the available wind. So if you get your buck boost amplifier and you stick it on and you get it tuned in quite correctly for the correct output current and the correct input voltage and output voltage, then yes, you can let the blade rotate closer to a speed that's optimal for its power output, and then they're generally adjustable, these amplifiers. You can adjust the output current so that at that speed, your everyday speed of, 4 meters a second, 5 meters a second, you can get an optimized current output. And doing that, you should get at least 50% more power than you're getting now.
So that's just, is that just using the buck boost straight onto the rectifier?
You get the rectified output into the buck boost amplifier, mm-hmm. then you put the buck boost amplifier as the charger to the batteries.
Yeah. And what about the capacitor bank?
Well, you can experiment with that. Mm-hmm. Capacitor banks are what go into the inverters. When you have the large inverters that we're using, that's what it meets. The cable goes straight into a bank of large capacitors, and that's what it uses to charge and discharge and switch internally for the inversion. So, yes, you could try that. The advantage of the battery over the capacitor is that the voltage range of the battery is comparatively small, and it starts at a relatively high voltage. So, for instance, if your battery's depleted, you're still at 10.8 volts on a lead acid battery when it's flat. So you've got a comparable speed for the blades of 10.8 volts when it's at its flattest. And then when it gets to full charge, obviously at 13.8 or up to 14.4, depending on the battery, then you've got, a higher rotational speed. Whereas if you start charging the capacitors will start charging from just above 0 volts. And so they will start effectively, it would be like trying to start the wind turbine in too high a gear. It's got to get moving. It's like trying to start off in a bicycle that the gear is too high that you're setting off in.
Yes, I noticed that when I tried to charge my capacitor bank when it was empty, it had, the power supply was saying, there's a short circuit, so I went out and I kind of whacked it across the battery terminals, and that seemed to put some charge into it. And then I could use my power supply, which is giving a much lower current.
Yeah, I mean, as something to reduce the ripple and the charging to the battery pack, then that's fine. But on their own, it will really annoy the system to have this large capacitance that it's got to overcome. The buck boost amplifier will help, but if it's feeding a purely capacitive output, it probably won't be quite very happy, I would have thought.
All right, so really just leave out the, just put the, so have the turbine, the rectifier, the buck boost,
yep,
and then the battery.
Yeah, and you're away.
Okay.
And it's just a case then of just setting the input and output voltages correctly, and then just adjusting the current value to your everyday wind conditions. That'll gain you about 50% more performance.
All right. So you choose a day when the turbine's just kind of chugging away, and yep, and tune a good voltage out of that. Very good. Very good. So we're at the top of the hour, just about, I was hoping to find The Wind of Change by The Scorpions, but I didn't, just to be cheesy.
How about Die Young by Black Sabbath? Gather the wind, so the wind won't help you fly at all.
Oh, man, but I can't find any music right now. Oh, okay, hang on. Fascinating conversation. I hope like so many people are kind of probably going, what the heck is this all about? But what it is these are the basic things. As Wynne has probably developed in his house, and as I have been developing in my house, and as you will probably develop as you listen to this show, in your house, little zones that are self-powered. This is how society is also going to be recreated, is we'll have little zones that are self-powered, like your house.
I think that's what we'll do after the break. I'll run through how you can start with smaller zones and make them bigger. Okay?
Okay. Well, look, the only one I can find right now is, I don't know how it segues, but anyway, this is AC/DC. It's a long way to the top. And welcome back. This is Full Spectrum with JP and my guest, Wynn Keach. And we're delving deeply down the nerd alley here, talking batteries and stuff, buck boosts. If anybody's like really interested in bug boost, there's some lots of great videos. My favorite guy on the internet who talks about stuff like that is called Big Clive, who's I think he lives on the Isle of Man. Apparently it was he who gave the jewel thief its name.
Oh, good man.
So he's one of these old electronic engineer kind of guys. And he takes these things apart. You know, the things that you see on eBay, you think, oh, nice little LED light bulb. And he takes them apart and shows you how they're all live as you touch the little metal rings around them. So he's a good sort of watchdog for that. So anyway, meanwhile, my guest, Wynn Keach, we are talking about bucking and boosting and, how you get your juice into your battery and keep it there, because that's the tricky bit. It just all seems to fall off. Where does all the energy go?
Actually, batteries self-consume quite a lot of energy. No, hour one was definitely nerd overload. This was, in fact, this is bucking and boosting and rocking and rolling. This is really JP's hour of how do I fix my wind turbine. Hour two, I intend to make it slightly more palatable and a broader remit for the listening audience.
Well, hang on a second. We have a nerd question from Paul in Newcastle. Okay, in Nerdcastle.
Out wrong with Newcastle.
JP, please ask the... it's not far. Ask the correct cable for a three-phase, three-core AC turbine at 15 meters.
You need a 4-millimeter cable, three-phase, rated to 520 volts.
Yay. For 15 points. And
we're gonna have a nerdathon.
That's right.
The nerdometer. I'm embarrassed to say I knew that answer.
Yeah, no, that's great. It's great. This is why we have people like you on the station, because people have real questions. And, you know, it's very likely that other people who listen to the archive of this, you know, and say, you know, how to run a personal energy house or something like that. Or actually, the word I used was energy farm. Everybody has their own energy farm.
Well, I have my own word for it. I call them my grid, and I have that designed. I have housing systems that I've designed entire houses, which I wish to produce, that are low cost houses that actually earn their living over a 10-year period by generating, saving, and exporting electricity.
Yay!
And that is possible now. That is now financially possible due to the lower cost of solar PV systems, inversion systems, the cost per kilowatt hour of storage, the number of cycles that storage can go through now. That is now economically viable. And it's something I intend to do ASAP.
So what do you need to make that happen?
Well, what I need to do is have 12 kilowatt hours of solar, a ridge blade, 32 kilowatt hours of storage, and a twin inversion system with my own smart authentication and remote control system. Uh-huh. But I have that. I have that. It's called MGRESS, which is Microgrid Renewable Energy Storage System. And fingers crossed, I already have an agreement for a very large Dutch energy company to trial 500 systems of that. Once I've finished messing around with wind turbines, which hopefully that phase is coming to an end now. There's various things I'm going to do, and I'll reveal you an exclusive towards the end of the show. That's the one thing I'm going to do. But yes, wind generation, we've sorted it. Storage, we presently have the best system available in the world that I run my house on. Mine's a Heath Robinson version of the real one, but nonetheless, it's been running my house for 4 years.
And what technology is it? Is it lithium, lead?
Lithium nanophosphate.
Lithium?
Nanophosphate.
Is that LiPo?
That's LiPo, yes.
So 18650s?
Effectively 18650s.
Okay, let me just explain.
But not in that format. They're in the large prismatic format.
Say that again. Large prismatic.
It's the same chemistry bit on a commercial size cell. That technology came out of the 18650 rechargeable battery for torches and power tools, etc., laptop power supplies. But there are various types of that size of battery that have different chemistries. It's very important in terms of safety, performance, cost performance. So for instance, the lithium ion batteries in your laptop, aren't as safe as the latest lithium nanophosphate batteries. The lithium carbonate batteries in your laptop look the same, cell size, same general performance, although actually they have a slightly higher energy density, which is why the likes of Tesla use them in their cars. But the old laptop type lithium ion batteries have safety problems in that if you crush it, it'll burst into flames and you can't put it out. If you actually overcharge it, it'll burst into flames and you can't put it out. If you drain too much electricity off it without cooling it, it'll go into thermal runaway and burst into flames and you can't put it out. So that is why you have safety issues with lithium-ion batteries, for instance, travelling on planes and putting them in the post. They have safety issues. Lithium nanophosphate is, and also lithium manganese, which Nissan used with the Leaf, those two chemistries are inherently much safer, that they don't generate oxygen when they go into thermal runaway, and they don't expand and contract through the charging cycle. So they don't have the same internal stressing, and they don't have the thermal runaway problem. So it's a much safer, slightly more expensive, and slightly lower energy density, but umpteen times safer technology. And that now is approaching the performance of the earlier batteries. The ones I use, for instance, they're good for 7,500 cycles. So you can put those in your system for 20 years and still have 80% performance out of them 20 years later if you run them at the correct depth of discharge cycle. You can have the cost per kilowatt hour, $300 per kilowatt hour, which 2-3 years ago was unheard of. You know, that cost has dropped to a quarter of what it was 4 years ago. Those two factors alone means that now you can actually have a depreciation cost per kilowatt hour cycle on that chemistry that is less than the cost of the electricity you're saving and transforming. So for instance, the latest lithium nanophosphate battery cycles, the per cycle of the type I use in my system, costs around 7 pence per kilowatt hour in terms of battery depreciation over the 20 years. Whereas the difference between a cost of an electricity unit in the daytime, which is around 18 pence and sometimes 20 pence in this country, and the night time, which is 7 pence, means that adding the depreciation cost and the electricity cost of the off-peak electricity, you get a per cost unit of 14 pence versus 18 pence. So you still have a 4 pence per unit used saving, just taking off-peak electricity and storing and reusing it through a regenerative system. That was not cost-effective 4 years ago. And if you tried to do that with lead-acid batteries, you would find that that cost was about 5 times higher, for instance. So these systems are now becoming economically, technically, safety-wise, they're now becoming viable. And I am on the cutting edge of that technology development.
Okay, so how many of these batteries? So, for instance, looking around my house, there are things that use up a lot of current. My electric kettle, for instance, mm-hmm. whereupon I make my tea when I need to because the stove is just out of the cycle and it's cold again and I'm trying to heat the water on. Long story. But anyway, so I need to, especially in the morning, I want a cup of tea. So to that end, I bought a 12-volt kettle. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than invert it and then burn a whole bunch of juice, I burn still probably about the same amount of juice without the inversion. Anyway, but the things that really seem to kill it are the washing machine.
Yep.
And the freezer.
Absolutely. These are the things I'm about to tell you about.
Yes, that's the thing. So
yeah, the kettle actually uses per couple of cups you boil at a time in it, you'll use about 0.1 of a kilowatt hour. But the actual peak demand from it is going to be 2.2 to 3 kilowatt. So it's a high peak, but for a short period of time. This is all load profiling. This is all part of what your house has to do with the electricity it has available. Some things take a large amount of juice for a short period of time. Some things take a small amount of juice for a long period of time or all the time. And other things use quite a large amount of electricity for a reasonable period of time, of which your washing machine is the worst offender. dishwashers are also the same. Now, what I wanted to talk about in this hour, which I think I will do now that you've segued into it quite nicely, is exactly these issues. These are the first things I experienced when, you know, when 10 years ago I thought, right, okay, I'm going to the main electrical switch to my house here. I'm going to throw it off and I'm going to find out how do I live with that switched off? What do I need most? What are the most important things? How do I go about replacing the electricity for those things? How can I do it technically? How can I do it economically? And when you do that, it's an interesting exercise. The first thing that happens is the thing you absolutely need more than anything else in the house is lighting, which is good because it's actually the simplest to actually find a fix for. Because lighting, if you use the lighting technology has advanced so much in the last decade that now you can produce a good amount of lighting for a relatively small amount of energy. So, as you say, you could now actually put copper foil into the ceiling before you decorate it to run cables rather than having to run actual electrical cables that if you're running low voltage to run, you know, down lighters, Cree LED, they can be anything from 2.7 to 12 volts. So, yes, you could run copper foil, aluminium foil even, through the ceiling. Perfectly acceptable. Whereas if I was going to use the same amount of light 10 years ago from incandescent lighting, I'd have to run a 1.5 millimeter squared 5 amp lighting circuit, which would involve me ripping a hole in the ceiling, pulling cables through.
Stiff and heavy copper.
Yeah. So technology advances help those things. Lighting's the first one. And the good thing with lighting is you can use it in a wide range. I'm very, very interested in lighting. Some people say I'm obsessed with it. I have a pocket torch collection.
Win. I really get the feeling that you and I are kindred souls. There is nothing that I like more. Get this. Than staring into the front window of a light bulb shop.
I like this. No, I'm the same. I get excited when I find a new torch. You know,
me too.
Call them flashlights. If I find new technology in a flashlight, I'm excited. I'm excited.
I've been buying Cree light bulbs for the last 2 years.
I have to have it. I have to take it apart. I have to see what the advances. You know, I'm obsessed with lighting. And I'll tell you what, a guy you would love to meet is a friend of mine in Holland, a guy called Taco Neeb, who I met. Taco invented the first domestic LED light systems, which he invented for Philips. Now, that was a nerd fest you would have loved to have been at.
Wow.
But anyway, lighting is important. And the good thing is you've got portable lighting, i.e. flashlights, which are always great. Flashlights are sort of, they're good for short gap sort of performance, i.e. the lights go out, you need to find where to turn the other lights on. So it's a bit like having a pair of glasses to find your glasses with. So torches are always great, or flashlights as the Americans call them. And the lighting technology is great. I mean, I have one here on my desk, not unsurprisingly, because there's a heap of about 20 of them on the other side of the desk from here. But that's a Cree unit, but it has the latest Cree cob lights, which the Cree at the front, quite efficient, that's 70 lumens a watt, which is acceptable for a high-performance Cree bulb. But has the latest cob technology, which is a strip light down the side, which is an area light, which will light this room up. And that's a 400 lumen cob, which is only consuming it's producing 120 lumens per watt, so is actually far more efficient than the Cree lights of just even 2 years ago. So the technology is fantastic. So there's a pocket torch that'll last 3 hours and light my room up in an emergency. Absolutely fantastic. Now, that was unheard of when I started looking at these things.
Yeah. The other thing, Wynn, that I've been also playing with is PIR lights.
Ah, yes.
So instead of, like, having the light running on low voltage, okay, that's fine. But how about lights that run on low voltage that come on when you need them and then go off when you don't?
Absolutely.
As in when you walk down a corridor. You don't
smart
need
lighting.
So, again, on eBay, for about £3, you can buy one of these lights. Now, the problem is, with this light, it's run on 4 AA batteries.
Yep.
Which are fiddly, and they run out quick. So I thought, well, since it's running on 6 volts, I wonder if it'll run on 2.7, and sure enough, yes, it does. And so basically, I put an 18650, with a little charging socket and a switch. Mm-hmm. And so They have a little sort of bayonet fitting onto the mount on the roof. So when they run out, I just twist them off, put them in my USB charger. By the way, I've got a 5-volt rail all around the house for charging USB things. As well as a 12-volt rail that I run lights and stuff off. So I'll also have another heavy-duty 12-volt rail for running amplifiers.
Because no, I don't need to do that. My UPS lightings all have the 5-volt USB charging points built into them.
So the USB lighting also has its own, so it's basically like a power bank with a light,
lighting, if you took your power bank, which is practically identical to the power unit I have in the bottom of here, and you hybridized it with, a standard lamp, just a standard, you know, freestanding 4-foot high room lamp. That's what you have, except your power bank you can pull out at a moment's notice and replace it with another one.
Exactly. That's very good. So I've been thinking about almost exactly the same thing for many little appliances.
They're running my house at the moment.
Exactly. and this is, you know, I feel a little bit like that guy in Blade Runner who's got all the little toys in his house that go, you know, but at the same time, I'm feeling my way into the future. This is the way things are going to go. Everything's going to go USB. Everything's going to go, I've been looking for the appropriate sockets. Because I discovered that you could buy these, this is where it all started for me, is, I had one of these little halogen lights that you buy these bulbs that cost a fortune, and then you stick them in, and you mustn't touch them, or they blow up. And when they blow up because you've touched them, you have to buy them more, and they're expensive, etc. And I discovered that on the eBay, I could find these little round, disc-shaped, lights that would replace them, and they were like 67p, which is about a dollar. So I sent away for some, and I was astounded by the quality of light that came off them.
Yep.
And they were, not only that, they were polarity insensitive. You could put them around either way, and they wouldn't behave like LEDs and blow up. They had rectifiers in them, and it's just amazing. You know, they would run on AC, DC, reverse DC. They seemed, they're indestructible, these things. And so I started, building, you know, I got some, oak barrels that, come off old whiskey barrels, and it's a lovely old kind of rustic wood. And I'm going to drill a hole into it and pop one of these things in it. And I've got these uplighters that I've made out of these pieces of barrel. And the thing that I was thinking, how do I join these things to the power supply? You know, what sockets do I use to join these things? And you know, and then obviously the gold foil, the copper foil, across the wall. That's still on the cards. I haven't actually implemented it yet, but I've got the foil, and, you know, I'm also thinking about, you know, remote control and things like that.
Anyway, we haven't even got halfway through lighting.
No, we haven't, have we? So anyway, you turned off your mains and there in the dark, the first thing you think, I need a light.
Is lighting. Right. Now, the first line of attack is your flashlight, your pocket torch, of which now there are some excellent ones. That's the thing that finds you so you can grope around in the dark and find where the switches are to the other things. And it's at that point you realise that, actually you can run the existing lighting circuits on the house on a UPS. I.e. you can take the existing wiring for the existing lighting, and you can run it all through a UPS that, when the mains goes off, that lighting circuit is still live. That's the simplest way. You don't have to rewire anything. You just replace the bulbs with LEDs, and the thing will last for ages. It's the cheapest, simplest, most effective way of doing it. And if you then take the power supply from the UPS, and as you say, you extend it to a bigger power supply, so you put a bigger battery on the outside, and to that you put a charge controller and some solar panels on the roof, you then have a self-sustaining light system where before you had a main system that just was connected to the mains. And that's what my main circuit in my house is. You know, I have, out in the shed is, you know, the shed has solar panels on the roof, it has battery bank inside, it has the inverter, it has the charge controllers. That all works completely automatically and feeds the power into my lighting circuits for the whole house. So every light in my house is run off solar panel solar panels from the shed outside.
And it's on, so you basically got a whole bunch of solar panels that then feed into a storage unit, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Let's talk about your storage unit, sir.
Well, there's various.
What's the cuff of your jib?
There's four around this house because there've been, my house isn't really a house. It's more a developmental center for technology. So there's a whole series over the last few years of systems and experimenting with systems. So what was my normal lighting circuit now is a UPS battery bank charge system running off a few solar panels on the roof. So, you know, a kilowatt of solar panels on my roof run the lighting for the entire house all year round, winter, summer, rain, shine, the whole thing. And if there isn't sun for 3 or 4 days, I have enough battery storage there to run the house for 3 or 4 days from the lighting. So that then becomes completely transparent. It's exactly as the system was before. You use the same switches, the same light circuits, the same everything. You just change your light bulbs to LED and you have a storage collection and inversion system, which is running that circuit. And that's the simplest way of doing it and the cheapest way by far. On the bigger scale, then I have the MGRES system, which runs all the big things in the house. So that's a bigger version of the same thing. That's got my wind turbine. It's got some solar panels. It's got a big heap of batteries and it's got a really, really big inverter.
Okay. So hang on a second. Let's just pause you there. The first system for the lighting, what's the amp hourage? How many amp hours have you got holding the charge for that?
Well, that's comparatively small. That has 360 amp hour of storage.
360 amps. So what we're talking about is three leisure batteries in parallel.
You're looking at 3 kilowatt hour of storage there on a lighting system. But I've turned every light on the house with these LEDs. I'm not consuming more than 120 watts.
Hmm.
So 1 kilowatt hour will run that for 8 hours.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you have 24 hours of complete lighting capacity storage on that battery system.
Okay.
That's available storage at 70% depletion. That's not the absolute storage system of the battery. The batteries are funny things. Depends on the technology you use, but generally the more you flatten a battery, the less time it's going to last, i.e. the number of cycles you get out of it, the lifetime of the battery will reduce. So there are optimum loading and discharging depths you can go to with batteries, and the different battery chemistries have different discharge lengths, for instance. So the lithium nanophosphate, I don't discharge below 70%, and that gives me 7,000 cycles. But if I discharge them to 80 or 85%, I'd only get 3,000 cycles, which would be 10 years life. So you have to do the cost calculation in that effectively, if I'm using it at a lower capacity, that has effectively increased the cost per kilowatt hour that I buy the batteries in because I have redundancy. So if I use the system in a harsher way, okay, the upfront cost is lower, but the cost per cycle actually increases. The lifespan of the battery decreases quite sharply, and so you also then have a maintenance issue. Also, the other thing is you have an inflation issue. So if I'm buying the batteries now at £300 per kilowatt hour, if I replace that battery in 10 years' time, the equivalent replacement cost due to inflation will mean that battery system will be around £4,500. If I replace it in 20 years' time, it'll be approximately £6,000 of the money of the day. So in terms of absolute cash, the longer you can get the battery to last, the cheaper you're buying a battery that would versus its replacement cost 20 years later. So the further you can kick that down the line, the actual relatively lower cost you're buying the batteries now. So if I'm getting 20 years life out of a battery, I'm effectively buying the battery for half the price it would cost me to replace it in 20 years time. Yeah, do you understand that?
I think so. Okay, so you got three hundred.
Yeah, this is just for the lighting, sir.
Yeah, just for the lighting. And are they lead acid, lipo, lino, nano? How do you shorten these nanopos?
Yeah, the lighting circuit actually just runs on calcium grid lead acid, whereas the MGRES system runs on lithium nanophosphate. It's two different dynamics, two different requirements, two different costs.
Mm.
Lead acid is cheaper, for instance, but the cycle life of it is much less, depending on how you run it. But because I'm never depleting the batteries more than 25% in a daily cycle unless it's an exceptionally dark winter, then the lifespan on the batteries is 5 or 6 years. So that's quite acceptable. Whereas if I was using lithium nanophosphate, yeah, I'd pay 4 times the cost per kilowatt hour for the battery, but I'd have the system last 4 times longer as well. So it's a trade-off.
Would it be possible also then, just as you're talking about this, you're saying, is it possible to top up the smaller system from the larger system? That's what I was going to say. Can you use the larger system like the mains
Potentially, yes. I mean, you can have a cascade system. You can use the mains to top up the other systems. I mean, when I started out, solar panels were only half the efficiency they are now. And, until we had the Ridgeblade, there was a shortfall in the energy production. So, yeah, when there was a shortfall, I had it automatically organized that off-peak electricity would top up the storage. So I always had 2 or 3 days storage in the battery system. And the batteries were always running at their most efficient voltage for both production of the electricity and also their lifespan.
Okay, so how many amp hours of the nanophosphate have you got?
32 kilowatt hours.
32 kilowatt hours. What's that in... What's that in amp hours? In terms of like a leisure battery or a car battery? How many is that? I know. And how does that compare in size and weight to that same, technology?
Well, per kilowatt hour, it weighs 1/4 of the weight of a lead acid battery.
And what about the space that it takes up?
It's about the same space, in fact, slightly less.
Okay. Are they supplied in a kind of big kind of rack mounting pack thing that you just kind of bolt in?
I have a modular environmental rack system, which contains the inversion, keeps water out in case the thing floods, all that kind of stuff, then a demountable battery pack at the bottom. It's what you would expect. If you imagine something the size of a small fridge freezer, but maybe half the depth, that has inversion at the top and a big stack of batteries in the bottom and a load of wires in between. Yeah.
Yep. So, say it again. How many kilowatt hours?
That's 32 kilowatt hours.
32 kilowatt. I'm just trying to get
as that. It's a little overkill.
I'm looking at the size of my thing, and I've got like two car batteries, two leisure batteries, and a car battery. So that's 270 amp hours. So
to have a viable house system, you need at least 20 kilowatt hours of storage. To have a good system, you need around 32 to sound spilly.
Right.
The nearest size.
Okay. So how much space does that take up, say, in your shed?
Half as much as a sort of typical stand-up fridge freezer.
All right, so it's about the size of an under top. What do you call them? Under sink top.
Well, it's not like that. If you can imagine a fridge freezer and then sort of slicing it in half in terms of its depth, that's what you'd have.
Okay, so it's a tall stand-up panel, right?
Yeah, because it's actually designed. Memgrace is designed to sit on the outside of your house, if you've ever played with these systems, if something were to go catastrophically wrong...
You want it on the other side of a big brick wall, yes.
You want it on the side of a wall, because if you've got 30 kilowatt hours of batteries that have shorted out due to somebody sticking a scaffold pole into it, for instance, or anything that could go wrong, you really want that on the outside of your house. You don't want it on the inside. Same with the inverters. If there was an internal failure of the inverter that caused an internal wiring fire, you would want that outside the house. You wouldn't want it inside.
Indeed. So, the next thing is, okay, so, this 32 kilowatt hours, I mean, what would that set one back to have one of these planted on the outside of your house?
The for sale system based on the one I have there is £9,600.
So, 10 grand gets you, or for just less than 10 grand, I can do the voice for you, for just less than 10 grand, you can have a, I'm not gonna, I would say, and, how can I say this? a far out battery.
the important, far out battery.
Yeah, stuck to the size. And then you need, great big cables that, that pipe it in. And inversion and things like that. And so what, again, is the size factor of the inverter pack?
Oh, well, it's got twin 10 kilowatt inverters in it. So you imagine the cable you use to run an electric shower. That's what you have times two. And that simply goes to your existing distribution board in your house. And it merely takes over.
So it kind of fits between... between the outside world and the inside world.
Yeah, so if you can imagine where the power normally comes into your big distribution board with all your switches and your fuses on, it sits just between there. So where the power comes in, instead of it going into your fuse box, it goes back straight back out of your fuse box again, into this box, and then back to feed all the fuses and switches.
Yeah, okay, so it just sits at that point between theirs and yours, just before that.
The important thing about the system is that it earns its keep.
Exactly.
Everybody else in the world is trying to put a battery in a box and say it's a house standalone system. You've seen the Tesla home system, which is completely useless, for instance. And everybody's trying to do that. This is entirely different. This is a system that's designed and optimized for cost efficiency and reliability, failover, failsafe, etc., etc. But more importantly, it earns its keep. The system we have here in the UK, obviously the dynamics change country on country, but in the UK, that system is designed to sit outside my house. Not only will it provide all the renewable energy my house can generate to the house, okay, so it'll take all the renewables that the wind, solar, or anything else I can put into it, it's plug and play designed to accept that energy and feed it into your house and any surplus to export. But in the background, it's still connected to the mains. Doesn't have to be, but if it's connected to the mains, it can earn its keep because it's also designed to export electricity on demand. So, for instance, the electricity companies will buy electricity at different rates at different times of the day. And at some times of the day, or due to renewable gluts, and certainly in countries like Holland, for instance, they'll actually pay you to take electricity if you can take it right now for the next 15 minutes. So it buys and sells electricity in the background to the extent that in the UK and in Holland, that system will earn £1,000 approximately per annum, 960 I think it works out, pounds per annum towards its upkeep. So over 10 years, that entire system has paid for itself, just the electricity it's buying and selling in the background for you, as well as providing the renewables for your house and providing an enormous grid storage. So it's actually smoothing the local grid. So not only is it running your house on one side of itself, as far as you're concerned, all the renewables are coming to your house and it's running your house. On the other side, it's using the spare capacity in the battery system to buy and sell electricity 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, little at a time in, little at a time out, so that when the grid says, we need electricity, it says, okay, I'll sell you some. There you go, have some electricity. And then when it says, wait a minute, all the wind turbines in Scotland have suddenly gone berserk with too much electricity, can we get rid of some? Because all the cables connecting to the rest of Europe can't cope anymore. And you say, yeah, we'll have it. And in which case, they'll either sell you it very cheaply or they'll even give it to you. So it has the ability to be smart enough to do that. And that's the big difference. Aha! I've done something good.
Sure. I mean, it just ties up a lot of these little loose ends. All right, here's my question, Wynne. All right.
We haven't got as far as the fridge yet. We've only got through lighting yet.
Well, hang on a second. No, because this is important. Okay. My big thing is frequency. Okay. So,
that's the other thing. It filters out all the nonsense on the grid coming in.
That's right. It cleans up the dirty.
Effectively, it's a firewall between you and all the horrible noise coming down the mains wiring.
Okay. So, but here's my question. Is it possible to tune it to 54 cycles a second?
Quite simply, yeah. Just tell the inverter what you want it to be at. Anything between 50 and 60 they can produce.
Because my secret desire is to set, because do you know what 54 cycles is?
It sounds like an overtone frequency, the Schumann frequency to me.
Well, it's an undertone of the 432 or 108 frequency that is in the pyramid. and it's very beneficial. Well, 432 is very beneficial. But
I can do you one of those, JP. That's not a problem. It's just a simple case of just programming it in.
So you have programmable frequencies. Excellent.
Yeah, yeah. The thing with solar PV is that they became a global product. So,
so you
a lot of the inverters can produce anything from 120 to 240 volts and 50 to 60 cycles. You just have to tell it what standard to output.
Well, if you know anybody who's got one of these things and are willing to experiment, to set their frequency to 54.
I have a big heap of them in my cupboard here, JP. I'll have to post one up to you.
Post me one, man. I'll test it.
I one thing you'll never be short of in my house are flashlights and inverters.
Quick, go and get me an inverter. I need an inverter stat.
Yeah, we may have no food, but we'll always have inverters to eat.
Excellent. So look, this has been one of my things because, one of my shows a few, years back, I spoke to a paranormal investigator who discovered that the frequency of 60 cycles a second was close enough as a subharmonic to the brain frequency that people were having hallucinations when they had a badly earthed fish tank pump, for instance.
Interesting. That's very interesting.
And of course, once he grounded out the fish tank pump, then, the weird things stopped happening. Your ring main is going to be humming. And of course, if you play an electric guitar or an electric bass, as you do, when you touch your finger to the end of the jack plug, that's the reason it hums is because you're humming with this frequency that's induced inside you.
Well, there's an awful lot of noise on the main circuits. The people don't understand that most of the internet, for instance, in this country, the trunk system goes up and down the mains grid system. That's where it goes. It goes up the big pylons. It's not just cable and fiber optics running around the place. A lot of the trunk data just goes up and down between all the main trunk systems on the grid.
If you got the right frequency circuit, you could actually tap into the main trunk of the internet.
Well,
using
obviously a lot of it's filtered out. It comes down and a step down transformer locally to your house, which a lot of that, will be inhibited by the inductance of the transformer. But nonetheless, that will cause harmonic fluctuations in that signal that's coming down. So although you won't get the data stream, what you will get is, the asymmetric digital pulses varying the voltage, which will be superimposed on your mains. So you'll have a dirty mains coming
through. It's like hearing a sidebander on the adjacent channel.
So if you have sensitive devices, fast responding devices like LED lighting, that noise could cause problems, for instance, which is another reason, it's one of the design considerations for Amgress is that you provided a buffer and a firewall to that you're getting clean mains at your side. You're getting it in a form that, is clean and healthy. It hasn't got any noise on top of it.
Right. So that's another advantage. It basically isolates you.
These are things I agonize over that most normal people don't. But
exactly.
Everything I do is an entire end-to-end product. I design things the same way that Tesla does. I design the entire thing in my mind, entire project down to the finest detail. And my considerations aren't normal people's. Most people in my position are driven by money. I'm not. I hate this stuff, right? I'm interested in ecology. I'm interested in trying to live like the Native American Indians would say, making the smallest footprint on the planet. That's the whole reason for my house. My house is trying to make the smallest footprint it can. In fact, it exports more electricity than it uses. It has zero environmental impact. And if we're going to thrive and survive as a society, we have to adopt these principles. And there are very few people that actually are willing to roll the sleeves up, get on and try it and say, what are the real issues? Let's just try it and see what happens. Most people will fall back to, I don't know what'll happen when the electricity goes off or doing it and thinking about it, two really different things. And I've had 10 years of doing it here. And when you do go down that route, what you produce becomes extraordinary because you suddenly realize the real issues of this. And that does temper how you approach things. So I'm not purely commercial on this, I've got a business to run, but at the end of the day, if I'm doing the right things, the business should be correct anyway. It's just that my motivation is to make sure we have the right product people can afford, is reliable, has zero eco impact. Those are my main drivers.
Reduce your karmic input. reduce your karmic footprint also.
Well, it's about taking responsibility for yourself and taking responsibility for your life and the way you live your life, because you're taking responsibility to live in harmony with the planet, live in harmony with the consciousness and the energy of the planet. And that's what it's really about to me. It's not about saving a few quid here or earning a few pounds there. It's not even being, you know, I'm the guy with the lights on when the rest of the city's got no electricity. To me, it's about taking responsibility for the way we live and making that a sustainable future.
Absolutely. So
anyway, that's lighting. We haven't got lighting. Lighting yet.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't even got to the computers yet.
Yeah, there's various lighting things we can do. Obviously, my UPS lighting is part of that process. That's one of the intermediate steps, that you can have a lighting system that is cheap, affordable, plug in and forget, and then when you need it, it's there, and you can charge it off the solar panel that comes with it and all that kind of stuff. But the next thing you find that you absolutely need to run is your refrigerator. Okay? That's the next most important thing. You wouldn't think it is, but it is. Keeping your fridge freezer going is the next most important thing. And that's a comparatively high drain. A typical fridge freezer is using around a kilowatt hour a day. It's using around a 10% of the electricity of your entire house. So that's the next thing, but it's not a hugely high load. It just has a large starting load for the motor. So generally they have 150 to 300 watt motor, but you need an inversion system with 6 or 7 times that capacity to ensure that the motor starts correctly. And ideally, for those kind of systems, anything that's got an inductive load on, motors, that sort of thing, microwave system, microwave ovens, that kind of thing, you need a pure sine type of inverter for that. So you need the higher quality inverter, and you need a starting capacity of at least 5 times, preferably 6 or 7 times the starting load of the of thing like the refrigerator.
So you're talking 6 kilowatts for a 300 watt fridge?
No. You're looking at 1800 watts for a 300 watt fridge, aren't you? You're looking at 1 kilowatt for a 150 watt fridge, yeah?
Okay.
I mean, I've got pure sine inverters here, about 600 watts. It'll start a fridge freezer okay 9 out of 10 times. But a 1 kilowatt one will do it every time. And that's what you want. Because the other thing you find out with inverters that's different to mains voltage. Mains voltage has the national grid behind it, so it's fairly resilient if you try to abuse it until the fuse pops or the MCB trips. Okay. If you use inverters, they're very sensitive to overloading, and in a matter of nanoseconds, if you overload them, that circuit will die. That inverter will switch itself out for safety reasons. So that's the other part of the strategy, is if you put critical systems like lighting on their own inverter that is of low demand, so that system is unlikely to trip out due to any single bulb failing, etc., etc., that's a much better strategy than putting everything on one big inverter to the house, because you could have a kettle that develops an earth fault, or washing machine that develops an earth fault, and you'll trip the whole house out in a fraction of a second. Whereas if you had the national grid connected to it, it would just likely just be a slight brown out for a half a second whilst an MCB traps out. So you have to factor in all those issues as well, which is one of the reasons, for instance, my inversion system has multiple inverters in it. Has critical and non-critical systems on two different inverters. So fridge freezer is a non-critical system, whereas the lighting is. So you would want, if you had lighting or if you had medical equipment, you would want those on the critical inverter. You want that, the most resilient circuit you can, that is designed to, against its own detriment, not fail. Whereas for general purpose performance, you have non-critical systems like your fridge freezer, your kettle, your washing machine, on a circuit that if something goes wrong with them, it trips it out and you simply reset it. But you're not groping around in the dark, your oxygen machine hasn't switched off, all that kind of thing. So you have to have all those kind of strategies built into this equipment when you get down to the fine detail.
So you really have to think about it.
Yeah, and I've had a long time to think about it and a long time to actually experience it. So, yeah, lighting is your number one, that's your most critical. Then your fridge freezer, and after that becomes your PC, charging your mobile phone, running your TV, and then all the ancillary equipment, your kettle, your washing machine, dishwasher, all that kind of thing. So all that's, you go down a gradation of critical to non-critical, low load to high load, high intermediate demand, low demand. There's a whole profile for all these things in the house. So you have to have a system that's designed to accept all those variants and also have a strategy for resilience under all the circumstances you want it to work, so that you have a normal experience with your electricity. Otherwise, if somebody just came along with a box and a battery and an inverter and didn't take all these things into consideration, one day you turn on the washing machine and the kettle and the whole house would switch off. And you'd be groping around the dark trying to find out what happened and reset it all.
So, I'll tell you when. What's going on in my mind is right. Underneath my fridge, a big fat lipo and an inverter. And actually, it charges itself.
You could have micro UPS. That's another way of doing it. Then it becomes a cost issue. It's like integrating the systems and components into a car so they're interdependent. If you have one big system that's running the house, then the actual cost per system is relatively lower. You can have a larger number of small distributed systems, but the relative cost goes up simply because you're replicating an extra box for everything and an extra capacity factor, and part of that capacity can't be used by the other system. So, there is an extra cost of making it into smaller and smaller systems, but it is a viable strategy, and each system is comparatively affordable. So, for instance, you could have a UPS system for your fridge that costs $100, say, and that would run your fridge for maybe an hour or two. And you could do that, and you could replicate that for your washing machine and your computer and everything in the house. And when you total it up, it'll probably end up costing twice as much as if you had one big system in the garage.
So this is like your wall system.
Because
you could do that though,
and you could buy it one piece at a time. You say, okay, I can afford this one this week, and I can afford that one next month. So yeah, you can apply both strategies.
So it can be built modularly.
You can do these things if you know what you're doing. First thing, you have to understand electricity, and a big part of my job is to take the complexity of standards of electricity and the physicality of the electricity systems and put them into plug-and-play systems that anybody can afford and use.
Absolutely.
Without having to understand it. The biggest thing for me, I always have people coming to me. I'm well known in the industry as being somebody who's got a well-rounded view of all these systems. And the thing that got me into this was the number of people that come and say, well, how can I do this in my house? How can I connect some solar to a battery, and how can I run the battery to an inverter? And you think, well, surely people know this, but actually no, you realize that you live with it day to day, and that you're concerned about the minutiae of an inverter design and the minutiae of a difference between a battery chemistry and another battery chemistry. Whereas most people are actually still struggling to work out how to plug all this stuff together.
Most people still worry about whether you put the red one or the black one, or you put the red one next to the black one, and then the black one connects with the red one of the next one along, or do you put the red one with the red one, and how do you charge a battery? Do you put the red one on the red terminal?
Exactly.
I mean, it's so complex two of these. You know,
this is where MGRES came from. MGRES came from a plug and play. Do it yourself, standalone, on off grid system.
Idiot proof. Is it idiot proof? I bet I could blow it up.
Do you want
to have a tester? Like, because I can blow things up and discharge things. Somehow about, you know, whenever I walk around, batteries discharge.
Yeah. You're like an energy vampire.
I run on electricity.
You're on electricity.
Yeah.
Are you AC or DC?
Well, I might be AC/DC. You never know.
but yes, these are the issues. So, for instance, when I did the Light from Light project, where you have a box with a solar, 20-watt
solar panel and,
three LED light bulbs pre-wired, with connectors in a system that you just simply plug them in. You can't plug them in the wrong holes. Everything's color coded. Everything's idiot proof. That's when you realize, you're providing a box to light somebody's house who's never seen a battery, never mind an LED light bulb.
Exactly.
We're doing this to replace somebody who's having to read their books by a paraffin lamp.
Yeah, or rub sticks together to make fire.
Yeah, and so something like MGRES or any microgrid system that you're ever going to see has to have that same ethos this is a system that's replacing an existing system and is improving it, but it has to be done in such a way that it's completely plug and play and completely idiot proof. It has to be completely resilient, standalone, reliable, and with a minimum capacity to be installed incorrectly.
Idiot proof. Very, very idiot proof.
that's where we go.
Excellent.
So that's where you end up with the house. And then after you've got your fridge, freezer, you've got your washing machine, your kettle and everything else running, the big thing you find is that the energy demand of your house is doubled by the fact you have to have hot water. And if you've ever had your backup system, which is going to end up being a diesel or petrol generator,
mm-hmm.
if you've ever tried being in a house like this one that has electrical hot water heating, you will find that when you start putting a number of 3 kilowatts electric loads on a generator, the thing just about falls over on its nose. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the disproportionate amount of effort to get one tank of hot water for a bath a day, you suddenly realise is an issue. And of course, when you can then start putting in overcapacity of solar and you can dump the extra load into it into low wattage trickle heaters for storage and that sort of thing, which I've done. That's fine. But really, next system is you want something that winter, summer, sunshine can produce hot water. And that's where we came up with Heat Grabber, which is a product you'll be seeing very soon from me, probably Ooh. Within the next 2 months.
Uh-huh.
Heat Grabber works with the existing solar panels, and it costs half as much as the existing solar panels. And for a typical 3 kilowatt of solar PV installation, it will produce a tank of hot water every day of the year, even where I live in Northern England. And all but 2 months of the year it will provide the heating for the house as well. And for the other 2 months, it will produce half the heating for the house. And that's a significant thing. It's approximately a factor of 6 less expensive than any other heat exchange system that's out there. And it's DIY, idiot-proof, fit-it-yourself system, which I may even be able to manufacture in the UK, although I do have a manufacturer in the Czech Republic ready to manufacture it now.
Excellent.
So that's the next product. So we've covered off the heating thing.
Have you explored cavitation heating?
I know all about cavitation heating, and it's very interesting in terms of its energy efficiency.
Isn't it?
But I don't need to. I'm simply actually literally sucking heat out of the solar panel system to make the solar panels run more efficiently, and taking that energy and putting it into your heating system and your hot water system.
So essentially you've got like cooling pipes running behind it that vampire off the energy, yeah.
Something a bit like that, yeah. It's a bit smarter than that, but that's effectively what's happening. It's vampiring the energy out of the solar system.
Mm-hmm. Well, because it's unused by the panel itself.
It's detrimental.
And is detrimental, as you say.
Actually, you lose 0.25% efficiency for every degree C above 25 degrees C.
Right.
The panels run out.
Okay.
Whereas in summer in the UK, with external, I've measured the panel temperatures here, 21 degrees C outside, which is a good summer's day in the UK, the panel surface temperature is actually 75 degrees C. Which means that you're losing approximately 8% of the panel efficiency. Which doesn't sound a lot, but when it only starts out with 14% efficiency, you're losing an awful lot of the output of your panels doing that. So, yeah, it's a big issue, but not for us anymore, because we have Heat Grabber, and Heat Grabber will actually work down to temperatures of minus 25 degrees C. That's what it's designed for. So that's coming out very quickly. That'll be my next product. And the last thing is that I'm getting out of the wind turbine business. My business is actually being negotiated for at the moment because I wish to do something somewhat altruistic, which is going to require me, as usual, throwing what little money I have at something else for the rest of the world to benefit from. And basically I'm putting together a barter trading system. Because as you may know, I started out from all this as a computer authentication expert. I wrote the PIN systems on all the credit and debit cards you use in the world, and a lot of the computer authentication software that you use for hard token replacement, etc. And I'm using those skills and a system that I've invented for a what can only be described as a holographic distributive barter trading system.
How very interesting. Do you know, Wynne? You know how I keep saying we've had some parallel paths?
Mm-hmm.
About 12, now longer than years ago, now, no, Now, 15, 16 years ago, I get involved with the LET system up here, and I as well am a computer programmer, and I was an access programmer, and I wrote an access application program. And one day I was thinking, what shall I call this? Oh, the Local Exchange Trading System Administration Manager. Oh, well, really snappy title. What's an acronym? Let SAM. Oh my God, that's really easy. Let SAM, and it became known as SAM.
Fantastic.
Based on the Rainbow Council.
If you want to join in this, JP, I'm putting a call out to anybody who wants to get involved from the
well, I'd be very,
floor.
Very, very happy to do what I can do. You know, whatever on a software level. Never, I haven't any time.
My vision is to have an alternative currency system, which is barter-based. Mm-hmm. But it's a system that's owned by everybody that uses it, and it's run for everybody that uses it. And the idea is that if as is quite likely, we're going to see a global economic reset this year, that you have a system that runs with the absolute value of things that won't be affected by any fluctuations in currency values or market values. You know, if you're going to trade your basket of eggs for half an hour's plastering and, three radishes, you can do it. Mm-hmm. But in a horizontal tiered distributive community environment, which can be local and it can also be international.
Excellent. We need to talk because I've been on the ground with LET systems, with distributed LET systems, with networks of LET systems, and we know how they can foul up.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I've modelled how these things can foul up. Yeah. But more importantly, I can also bring the end-to-end authentication to this at zero cost, which nobody else can.
Excellent. Excellent. So,
bearing in mind, I actually had this system running 20 years ago on GSM-1 systems. I had a 5 kilobyte Java app, which ran on Series 1 GSM phones. Mm-hmm. And I designed it so that you could have a secure transaction. One phone as a point of sale, one phone as a virtual credit card. And if you had a mobile signal and you were stood on the moon, you could make that transaction secure.
Excellent. So, Wynn, one last thing, because I've got to go over to Strange Universe in a few minutes' time. And first of all, thank you. I've really enjoyed it. I don't know how anybody else has.
I don't know what the rest of the world thinks, so I think we've barely scratched the surface, to be honest.
Please come back. We've got loads to talk about. I've got loads to learn about. You've got loads to teach. It's brilliant to have you along. So thank you so much, Wynn. As I said, I've got to get along to Strange Universe in a minute, so.
I'd be amazed if anybody's managed to stand the 2 hours and survive this nerdiness.
No, there are nerds out there. We have nerd brothers, yes.
This is all part of the issues of how we go forwards, I see, as a civilization, that, you know, we have to take responsibility for growing our own food without any additives in it, without any GMOs, without anything horrible. So we have good health, we have the ability to generate our own electricity without damaging the environment, we have to be able to trade as a community with confidence with one another, and we have to build communities. We want to do exactly the opposite of what's happened for the last 300 years on this planet.
Exactly.
We need to come together as one race of humanity and build a proper world that is owned and controlled by us and not by people who make the wrong decisions and make civilization go in a way that's suicidal to itself.
And with that, Wynn Keach, thank you very much. This has been Full Spectrum.
Thank you, JP.
You're very welcome. Good night.